This week on Retronauts.
Classic video games just get better with age, but you can't really say the same thing about the human brain. In fact, there's an entire subgenre of puzzle games centered around keeping our minds young and agile. But for people who want to keep their minds sharp without worrying about how some video game wants them to pronounce the word blue, there's Focus Factor. Focus Factor is the only double-blind, placebo-controlled, clinically proven brain health supplement on the market. Its combination of neuronutrients, vitamins, and minerals has been designed to improve memory, concentration, and focus. It can also replace your daily multivitamin. So, give America's number one brain health supplement a try and feed your Einstein. By that we mean your good Einstein, not your evil genius Dr. Wily version of Einstein. That would be bad. Right now, Retronauts podcast listeners can take advantage of a special discount code for Focus Factor. Just visit focusfactor.com and use the discount code RETRO10. That's RETRO10 to receive 10% off your order today.
Hey everybody, Bob here, and you might be wondering why a guy who gave up driving 5 years ago has any business at all reading an ad for something like TrueCar. Well, I know firsthand all the baggage that comes from owning a car, the insurance, the maintenance, gas money, and choosing the perfect bumper sticker to sum up your complex belief systems. And before all that, there's figuring out which car to buy in the first place. So if you're in the market for a new ride, consider turning to TrueCar. With TrueCar, you can see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. Information that empowers you to feel confident. Once you register with TrueCar, you can connect with a certified local dealer and see real pricing on actual inventory. And with over 13,000 certified TrueCar dealers nationwide and over 3 million cars sold by TrueCar dealers, you can rest assured that TrueCar has a history of happy customers. Customers who, on average, save $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. Hello, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of Retronauts. I am your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and this is quite possibly the spookiest episode of Retronauts I've ever hosted, not because of the subject matter, but because all the power went out in our vault studio, so we had to basically drag a surge protector in here and light the room with our iPhones. So this is basically like telling ghost stories, but the subject is very much alive, so don't worry. Today's episode is about Mario 3. It's one of our kind of heavy hitter episodes. I like doing these because I feel like the fact that these sorts of games are good is sort of conventional wisdom, but I think it's a good idea to occasionally go back and look at them again and remember why we like them so much instead of just saying, you know, taking them for granted. Of course this game is good. Before I go on, who else here is here with me today?
Oh, hang on a sec.
It's me, Jeremy Perry.
Jeremy, that does not work in audio. Jeremy just took my iPhone is wrapped in a bag, by the way. This is our high-tech studio, and he held it under his chin. But
it was so scary for everyone else.
Yeah, I was scared. I'm trembling now.
That was some Foley work. He was walking around in hay.
Yes.
Spooky
He
farm.
Was wearing plastic chains made of plastic bags. There was a chain.
These are the plastic bags I forged in life.
I don't know what that's a metaphor for, but who else is here today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and man, it's so dark in here. I think I'm in World 8.
Oh, I get it.
With me today, so I'm one baseball cap away from doing retro game videos on YouTube.
Oh, man, you need to be, well, Ray, talk about
my pickups this week. I got this here Jeopardy 25th Anniversary Edition for Sega
Ray,
Genesis.
Let was good eating.
You've missed your calling, but you need to be sitting in front of a giant, like, shelf of things to prove you're a real gamer because you have to buy things to be a real gamer.
Yeah, but you watch those videos and you notice those guys always intonate the first words of games really weird. It's
Super Mario Brothers.
Like Super Mario World. It's like, are you that slow? I don't get it. Anyway.
Ray's been doing some research.
This is the Punching Down podcast, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
We take out enemies that are smaller than us. But yeah, today's episode is all about Mario 3. And I mean, I think everyone in this room agrees that this is a great game. I mean, Henry's wearing a Mario 3 t-shirt, so unless he's a liar.
I mean, yeah.
Big Mario nerd.
It is my – it used to be my favorite Mario game. I'd actually knock it down to – third favorite 2D Mario game now, but I do love it ever so much, yes.
And everybody,
wow,
I mean,
New Super Mario Brothers really knocked it out of
New Super Mario Brothers 3.
Just the DS version for me. But yeah, today's episode is about Mario 3. And before we get started, I want to talk about some of the people behind it. And I will say we've covered a ton of these people in detail in past episodes, so please revisit our past episodes to hear more about these folks. But I will at least mention the team of 11 people who made Mario 3. And if you're a regular Retronauts listener, you should know most of these people by name. But of course, we have Shigeru Miyamoto. I don't think I need to tell you who that is, but in case you don't know, he created Mario and Zelda alongside Takeshi Tezuka. And they were both sort of the architects of those two games, and they're kind of the biggest creative forces at Nintendo, at least on that side of the company.
We like to refer to him as Shigs around here.
Shiggy, I think.
We're not British. No. We don't say Shiggy.
I'd prefer you didn't.
Is Shiggy a British thing?
No, it's just a jackass thing.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I mean, aren't they interchangeable? I kid.
I haven't seen Shiggy on the internet, written on the internet, since like maybe 2003.
I never saw it written Shiggy until Shiggy. I worked with British people and they, who did that and also wrote Rezzy.
No, they would call him like Shaza or something.
Shaza. What the heck? Is that a magic spell? I can picture an interview with him in like 1999 titled Getting Shiggy With It. And I'm
all
sure right. that
I
happened.
I disapprove of all this. This season.
I'm sure I read that in Next Generation.
Please scan that in and send it to me. I'm sure it happened.
Ray just walked out.
Okay, so we have Shigeru Miyamoto, Takashi Tezuka. We all know who these two guys are. I mean, they're super great game designers. So we also have Katsuya Iguchi.
Katsuya, sorry.
Thank you, Ray, who's better at this than me. He's a level designer on the game. I don't hear him that often brought up that often in games for Nintendo, but
he's the Animal Crossing guy.
He is the Animal Crossing guy. He created it. I guess he probably produces every game, but he directed Star Fox 1 and the unreleased Star Fox 2.
I've had some interviews with him, kind of, but it's always with his protege, Ayakio Goku.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Iguchi just kind of sits in the corner and like occasionally she'll ask him like, can you say something?
Oh, but I see.
He's just kind of like the lurking presence. Yeah, I think he's ascended to executive heaven.
He's above talking to journalists, I guess.
Well, he also was like a key designer of the Wii U, I remember. He was like at the E3 of Wii U 2012, he was a key person to talk about Nintendo Land. Like that was his baby. Though don't blame him for that, but
So we also have Kensuke Tanabe, another level designer. He, of course, directed Mario 2, otherwise known as Doki Doki Panic. Yes, I have to say this in every episode.
Did you know?
It's been the one piece of video game trivia for the past 20 years that everybody knows. But he directed that Mario 2. He is now Nintendo's retro producer, and by that I mean the company Retro, who now makes the Donkey Kong Country sequels that are really good, better than the Rare ones, in my opinion.
He probably accounts – sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I don't want to spoil.
More Tanabe facts. Okay.
No, I was just going to say his presence probably accounts for the presence of Mario 2 elements.
Oh, yeah, I can see
being
that.
Being inducted into Mario canon through
like
Mario
3. Like bombs and Ninji. Yeah, that's right.
He was probably in the room saying like, these things were cool, guys.
Remember that Doki Doki Panicu game?
So we also have, of course, Koji Kondo, music and sound effects. I mean, he's the Mario composer. He has a team now that helps him, but it was basically just him in this era. Some other names we have Hiroyuki Kimura, character design, and Hideki Kono, character design and level design. We talked a lot about him on our Mario Kart episode. He was sort of he is the Mario Kart head honcho now. Is that correct? I can't remember if it is Kono at this point.
Pretty much.
I don't retain any information after these things end, so you'll have to remind me.
And there's one other name I'll add to that too.
Oh, sure.
Is Yoichi Kotabe.
That's right, yeah.
All the art, including the Mario 3 art that is on the cover, that is on my shirt, and all the amazing pictures that are in the instruction manual, that was all by him. He had been hired in between 1 and 3 to be the official in-house Nintendo artist, who, especially on the Mario series, like he was handed the cover to 1 and like, could you make a defined art style for Mario based on Miyamoto's cover to 1 in Japan? I mean,
I do love his art the best. But I will say, Henry, as much as I love how iconic that cover for Mario 3 is, Mario and the raccoon with the raccoon tail taking off, I think Mario 3's Japanese box art could be my favorite box art of all time.
It's a great box.
It is like basically look at all the shit that's in this game. It's just spilling out into the wilderness. It's just everything in the game is on that cover. Maybe it's too busy for a non landscape box. You know that because we had portrait boxes.
If you were to put that ad on an HD, well, yeah, we had portrait boxes, so there was that. And also, you put that on like a non HD television. It's very busy. I, as a piece of art, I like the three cover more, and I also love the Japanese three cover more. And I love the Japanese commercial for three, which basically ends with a moving animated version of that cover.
Yes.
It's really beautiful.
As I said in the Mario Kart episode, look up the Japanese commercials for all of these games. They're all like anime or claymation or something whimsical you haven't seen before. It's not like the edgy 90s advertisements that you're used to.
But I'd say for the American side of it, like it was just simplicity of like, this is all we need. Yellow background and Mario in a raccoon suit, like, boom.
It's like, listen, kid, Mario can fly now. Start bugging your parents immediately because this is all you need to know.
And that became Vogue later with like Final Fantasy VII and Metal Gear.
I actually really liked the extreme Mario 3 ads in America, like the one where Mario flips a skateboard and then vomits on his mom's face.
I like the one where he keeps eating food and then explodes. It's my favorite. And to finish out the rest of the team. What's that?
Shouldn't have eaten that mint.
Nope. One wafer thin mint. And we also have four programmers who I will not name because I only have so much time. They're also very important, but they're programmers and they do a great job. But I mean, these are like the top of the line people are the ones I wanted to talk about. And if you go back to all of our Nintendo episodes, you will learn more about them. I just don't want to spend time here reiterating stuff we said in the past. I mean,
I think it probably would have been faster to have just like named the four people than to give the disclaimer.
Well, this I'm just wrapping up. Well, geez, Jeremy's giving me live notes, everybody. So please leave a comment about that.
I feel bad for them. I mean, there's some really great programming on display in Mario 3. It's a technical masterpiece.
Well, I'm sorry I let everybody down in the first.
We're in San Francisco, where engineers are like gods here.
Yes,
changing the world.
Well, Bob's an atheist. So.
Yes, I'm also very high right now. So let's move on.
So that core team of people. I love seeing that list of the core team of people because you can see Nintendo from then, each generation as teams grew and grew, they still kept those core of people, but they just started like get spread out like, you know, like butter on toast to different areas. Before they were all concentrated on like, okay, we're the guys on this team, and then it's like, well, no. Okay, Tezuka will direct this game, and Miyamoto will direct this game, and Iguchi will direct this game. And then you get in the N64 era, they're like, well, you're in charge of this team, and I'll be in charge of this team, and
So that's why Mario 3 has a yellow box, because of butter?
Yeah, exactly.
You can make that connection, I think. I mean,
amazing.
Even at this stage, Miyamoto is becoming less of a hands-on kind of guy. I'm sure he is hands-on with this game, but he's not as hands-on as Tezuka is with this game. He's already escalating to that producer role, which he will have soon, because he was not the director of Mario World. That was Tezuka, correct?
Right.
Okay, yeah.
Tezuka pretty much ran the show.
Yeah, I mean, he's like the main designer. That's what director means in this context.
I love that man. He's great.
I was glad when he finally got to be in front of cameras more and do more interviews and be known to the public as
– I don't think he wants to, though. He seems very shy.
He's a very shy goofball. I feel that. And he also, I think when I interviewed him one time, I didn't ask him for this, but he described his relationship with Miyamoto as like, you know, senpai and kohai, that like Miyamoto's the upperclassman. He's always going to be the boss. Even as Tezuka enters his 60s, he's like, well, but Miyamoto's the boss, you know.
He's still waiting for senpai to notice him. So let's move on to the production of Mario 3. And for some reason, I thought there were more interviews about this game in existence. I looked on Shmuplations, I looked on Glitterberry, I did some hardcore searching. There was one printed by Nintendo Power, which is a very surface-level interview, and I'll talk more about that later. But the one I think is really interesting was one that was done for the release of the NES Classic. And it astounds me that they were just holding on to these facts about this game for almost 30 years, and they just came out in this interview because –
that's their MO though.
Yes, exactly. It's just like, oh, we thought you should know
this. Time is right.
Yeah. Yes.
I think it is now time for you to learn the secrets of this game.
you finally earned it with your loyalty. But
we passed 20 million sales. You're allowed.
God, how many copies did this game sell with Virtual Console? Who knows? But so the strange origins of this game is that Mario 3 started as a game experienced from an isometric perspective. So just imagine that for a minute.
Crazy.
No, thank you.
They wanted to make it as different from Mario 1 as humanly possible because Japanese Mario 2 was basically Mario 1 plus extra stuff, like plus more difficulty.
They realized that they had Rare like as their as their like pet company, like a second party in America, like, right? They could have just said, Rare, can you do this Mario game
for us?
Did
they play any of those isometric games though? I don't know how they would ever think it would be a good
fit. The dream of an isometric Mario came true in Mario RPG and saw how good the platforming in that was.
Yeah, but so. I also like how there's like seven isometric Sonic games.
Oh, God, yeah.
But, funny how things are going.
I'm a Spot Goes the Hollywood fan myself.
Hearing how different it was or it was originally planned to be, it further solidified my fan theory that this really should just be called Super Mario Brothers 2. Like, we got Doki Doki Panicus 2. In Japan, they got Super Mario 1.5, basically. So, but meanwhile, this one, which should have been like the Zelda 2, this is the Zelda 2, or they wanted it to be that weird and different. Like, that is my theory.
It really feels like that.
But Mario 2 for America was the weird one.
It was weird, but not – yeah, it was weird. But it was weird in a different way. It wasn't planned to be the weird Mario. Like,
it was a weird Mario by happenstance. Like, let's just make this game a Mario. Right. This one was made as different as possible from the ground up. Of course, we all know it didn't become an isometric game. But apparently the black and white checkered four that sort of tapers off into the perspective, that's a remnant of that period of development, which I'm guessing didn't last long because they're like, we can't do this. Like, how would this – I want to see a prototype. I want to see how far they even got with this because I can't imagine this ever being a good game.
No. There is basically an isometric Mario platformer in Super Mario 3D Land.
You're right. Yeah, like, right.
They should call it Super Mario 3D Land
but
Stalker.
The difference is that has polygons, which makes it more convincing to render 3D.
It does, but I don't know. Like, I feel like you could take that concept and it could work in you know, with sprites and bitmaps.
I disagree violently, but we have to move
okay.
on.
So debate me, Bob.
Mario 3, no. I've hung up my debating hat.
Damn it.
I only debate for charity. And the price starts at $50,000. So Mario 3 was developed over the course of 2.5 years, which is an incredibly long time for an NES game. Like, I'm thinking of the games that took around 18 months to 2 years to develop, and they're all like Dragon Quest or things like that. Like, a platformer did not take almost 3 years to develop, but it's basically because it's like, we want to put as many ideas as possible into this game, and we want to make them all implemented perfectly. We don't want an idea to come off the wrong way. Like, I feel like, and maybe Jeremy can weigh in this a bit because I think he has some opinions on this. This feels like this team's like 8-bit finale before moving on to the Super Famicom. Do you think that's...
It was, in fact, their 8-bit finale. Okay. After this, they did move on to Super Famicom. This game, they wrapped in 1988. Super Mario World launched in Japan in, I want to say, November 1990. Is
that's
that right?
Right, yeah. And
that game took about 2.5 years to develop. So you do the math there. And basically, they wrapped this game and went immediately to figuring out how to make this new hardware work and how to design games that would take advantage of it and so on and so forth.
Yeah, Super Mario 3 came out in 88 and that is in Japan. And that is when the development of the Super Famicom started, possibly earlier than that. We don't really know. But at least in 1988, I mean, that's when these CD-ROM deals were struck and things like that.
The crazy thing is this game came out in Japan like about a month after Super Mario Brothers 2 came out in the US. They could have just said like – you know, instead of converting this game about cartoon characters into a Mario game, why don't we just do a simultaneous release for Mario 3 worldwide? But they didn't do that, which is strange.
Simultaneous releases were like
they
crazy.
Happened. Super Mario Brothers was almost a simultaneous release.
That's true. That's true.
They didn't even have like a system in America when they released Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, but all you had to translate was the manual for Mario 1.
Yeah,
I guess. But it's not like there was a ton of text in Mario 3. I don't know. I just think it's interesting that like this very obvious direction that they could have taken, they didn't take, and they held back Mario 3 in the US for 2 years, a year and a half, almost 2 years.
I think they really saw an opportunity to milk fans in a healthy way. It's like we can give them two Mario games and make them wait, and then we can figure out how to build up to this next game with like marketing and with promotions. We'll talk more about that later. I think Mario 3 was the most heavily marketed game Nintendo had done up to this point.
Nintendo always takes the least obvious path, and this is them doing that way back when. Like, it doesn't make any sense for them to have taken the approach they did with the US releases, but I'm glad they did because I really love Mario 2, and I really love the ways that it enriched the Mario universe, which you begin to see with Mario 3.
Well, and let's not forget those chip shortages, too. That's why we didn't get here, right?
Wink, wink, wink. Those really happened. So we're going to take a small break, and we'll come back with the meat of this podcast, the actual game Mario 3. Super Mario Brothers 3, that's our topic for today. And it came out in Japan. I don't know if these dates are accurate, by the way, because who knows at this point with these with this
Japanese
era of
one
gaming.
Is.
Japanese dates are always precise to the date.
That is true.
Small country.
I meant more the American. I guess there's not a lot of places to ship it in Japan. I mean, not a lot of distance to travel. But it came out in late October of 88 in Japan and about 18 months later in the United States. And I mean, 18 months is not much now as we're all rapidly dying old people. But when you're a kid, that is an unimaginable amount of time between an American and Japanese release. I mean, I was used to waiting that long for, like, again, RPG localizations. But as Jeremy said, like, they released Mario 2 and they made us wait for Mario 3. And I was seeing coverage of Mario 3 around this time in magazines like EGM or something like that. I remember seeing this game
I remember
being
game
covered.
Informer.
Game Informer? Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was definitely available to savvy gamers who knew how to get their hands on this.
Yeah, I wasn't that advanced yet though as a kid.
Like, I wasn't, no.
I didn't know it was still going to be that it had been out for over a year. I only knew once the ad started in America. And I mean, I was only 7 when
I have friends who are like, they knew Mario 3 was out in Japan like when it came out and they coveted it and it like drove them obsessive. And I had no idea. I was like, okay, there's another Mario game coming at some point, but I hadn't really followed it that closely.
Just imagine like pre-eBay days, you could just live in Japan and run a business of mailing Mario 3 to people in America.
I think lots of people did that, right, with those mail order things.
But
it's like diehard game fan.
And then like you'd send away for that stuff and you'd be waiting like a month if you're lucky to get that game. But
yeah, and I mean I only found out about this. I believe like is 1988 on the title screen in America too, like 1988, 1990.
It probably says
Nintendo.
1988, 89.
Like for some reason I just ignored that, and it wasn't until I was reading like things like Kevin Gifford's website and things like that when I realized like, oh, this game actually is an 88 game, which is astounding for how sophisticated it is. I mean, 88 had some great games for Nintendo, but this seems way ahead of its time and for a lot of reasons. Before we go on to talk about the design of the game, I want to ask all of you guys when Mario 3 entered your life. And I'll go last. How about you, Ray? When did you discover this game? How early were you on board? When did you get it?
Yeah, I think it was the Wizard. But let me put that into context because like, I got an NES in like Christmas 88. And so I was pretty late and I really not heard of video games before that. So I didn't even know about the shortages of Mario 2 and Zelda 2 because I didn't really know about those anyway. So because I was a latecomer, I didn't really like Mario that much either. So I was late to even getting Mario 2 because that was well after the shortage. But then, yeah, I think it was the Wizard where that was just sort of revealed and it's like, oh, well, yeah, now I'm in this for real. Now I love video games. Now I love Mario games.
You needed that Mario 3 is coming. Fred Savage endorsement.
Yeah, and then what happened, you know, but that period from like 88 and 89 was just like me totally diving into Nintendo games and discovering all this stuff like Mario and Ninja Gaiden and Mega Man and things. And so Mega Man 3 was also coming out that same year, and so it was just like this doubleheader of really big games that I couldn't wait for and just sort of like – really made a very good year for 7-year-old me.
How about you, Henry?
You know, I was also a latecomer to the NES. I got it in – I would bet it was 88 or 80 – let's say 88. And I just saw my next-door neighbor playing Super Mario Brothers and it enraptured me like nothing ever had. And then I spent the next 2 years like as the biggest Mario fanboy ever, like not just playing Super Mario Brothers all the time, which my mom and brother also super got into it. but buy Mario clothes, watching the cartoon religiously, like doing all these things. And so then when the marketing blitz began, I was so ready to give everything to Super Mario Bros. 3. Like, so once it came out, I remember – I think it was the first time I ever bought just a game by itself because like we rented Super Mario 2. We didn't own Super Mario 2. I bought a game by itself and was just like – the process of open the box, go through the manual,
open the little plastic bag,
beautiful. Yes,
and read the safety instructions.
So it hit me at the perfect time, and I played it to death.
Well, Jeremy's a bit older than us, so I assume he found out about it in the New York Times or something.
I remember back in '03.
He spat out his brandy and was like, "By Jove, I must order this game." So, Jeremy, I'm kidding.
About the farm report.
He was also very British as a teenager.
Yeah. I didn't drink brandy.
Oh, come on. All right. Fine.
Just vodka.
Okay. Well, when did you discover Mario 3?
I don't actually remember. I mean, I wasn't really that excited about the game because, you know, I had a couple of friends who lived in the same block as me who owned NESs like in 1986. Like they were really early adopters and I played Mario at their homes a lot. So by the time I got my NES, I was like, oh, it comes with Mario. That's exciting. I did pick up Mario 2 because it was so weird and exciting and interesting and like Nintendo Power did a really good job of selling me on it. It was just like a very different looking game and I loved that. And then I saw Mario 3 and I was like, oh, it's just going back to the original Mario.
But they gave it a clay cover.
I mean I think I first saw it in like I said Game Informer or something. I saw like some screenshots and I don't know what it was but there was something about the visuals that didn't look like an NES game. It looked more like an EGA PC game. Like the colors were kind of flat and the palette seemed a little different than I was expecting from an NES game. It felt like – in a way, it felt kind of advanced. I was like, this doesn't seem like an NES game. This seems like it's kind of like – should be on the next system. But at the same time, I was like, it's still just Mario like running and jumping and you can't pick things up and all the enemies are like the enemies from the first game. So I don't know. But you know, eventually I did see things like the giant world and I guess that was when I was sold on it. There was a PlayChoice 10 at the local university and I was there for some school event after hours and I went to the arcade at the university to kill some time and I saw Mario 3 playing on the PlayChoice 10. This was before it came out in the US. Yeah. And I saw some dude playing Giant World, World 4, and I was just like, how can you do that? Yes.
This shouldn't
and
be happening.
I saw for like 10 seconds, but that was enough to just like sear into my brain. So when the game did come out – and I never saw The Wizard. I've never seen it.
You're not missing it. You're not missing much.
I don't imagine. But like when it came out, then I felt like I needed to own it. And so it came out I think February 1990 and my birthday was the next month and I got it for my birthday.
That works
so
out.
It turned out pretty well.
Yeah, I mean I think I'm the only one at this table who never owned the cartridge. I'm sure – I don't know how I found out about it but I'm sure I was inundated with The Wizard, which I didn't see until I did the Retronauts about it 5 years ago.
Cut.
So you're the only one who saw The Wizard, Ray?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't see The Wizard as a kid either, but somehow it was on TV. I saw the clip of how to get the whistle in the game.
Bunch of these fake gamers here. I can't believe this.
So that's how I knew how to get the whistle when I played the game because I was like, oh, yeah, I remember that clip from The Wizard. Crouch down on this white block and I'll get that whistle.
And I'm sure in the commercials they would show you like a second of Mario 3 to get you in the door. I'm sure I saw it there and I'm sure Nintendo Power sent the message like if you don't buy this game, you will have no friends, your family will abandon you, your pets will die because that was what Nintendo Power was all about. But I was a very savvy and shrewd child. And I didn't get very many games a year just because of like I didn't have a source of income. There was birthdays and Christmas and basically that's it. So I was like, hey, wait a minute. All like 9 of my friends bought Mario 3 and I could just play it at their houses anytime I want. I'm just going to play it there and buy something else.
Smart.
So that's how I experienced it. But that didn't stop me from buying the strategy guide and, you know, watching the cartoon and doing all the stuff. But I never actually owned a copy of the game until I bought it on Virtual Console for like everything Nintendo released. But I never owned the cartridge. And
well, I know what to get you for Christmas.
Ooh, yes. I'm sure those are incredibly rare.
There's only a few million of them in the world.
Yeah.
A few dozen million.
Mint in box only.
18, wasn't it? Isn't that the number they gave?
18 million?
I think I'd heard that at one point.
Is that
I
all?
I think so. I think it was the highest.
Mega bomb.
I think it was the highest selling non-pack-in NES game ever, I believe.
So I just checked the sales of this game, and it sold 17 million copies, okay. Which
The NES sold 52 million units, right? Something like that. So that was basically a 1-to-3 install rate.
It's pretty good attach rate. Yeah, I mean, if you look at, again, as I told you in multiple episodes, like think about a game you like and think is popular, then look at the best-selling games ever. You'll realize that nobody plays the games you like. It's just like Minecraft, The Sims, Nintendo.
I only like GTA 5.
GTA 5, yes. Those are the games.
Yeah. It does bum me out that Minecraft has like surpassed Wii Sports now, but
Minecraft is good though.
I know, I'm an old man and I get it.
But. It's infinite Legos. It's what you always wanted, right? At least what I always wanted.
I built the Legos the way they told me to. I was not a creative kid.
And then I put them in the closet. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the game itself. It's a. It came out on a 3 megabit cartridge.
Good God.
With an MMC3 chip. And I definitely recommend the book I Am Error to learn more than you ever wanted to know about the inner workings of the NES and how it displayed graphics. But essentially, this chip was engineered just to have a status bar on the screen.
Right.
Was that its only function, Jeremy, just to split the screen? Have one stationary area.
Well, it had the IRQ feature, so you could do the split screen. I think you needed an MMC3 to be able to scroll diagonally. I could be mistaken about that.
Yeah, this game scrolls in every direction, so that could aid it with that too.
Because like MMC1 games, if I'm thinking correctly, stuff like Metroid and Kid Icarus and so forth, like those only scroll in one direction at a time. I think diagonal scrolling was something that you had to have the MMC3 for.
Hmm.
And also, it had more like character memory and more graphical memory, so
it could be
a bigger game.
There's a lot of things in this game. And it is a huge game. There are roughly 90 levels, give or take, depending on what you consider a level. Most levels don't – I mean, there's a real change in level design for this game. Most levels are basically like a minute long if you're playing them well. And playing it again, I was astounded. Like some levels are just like, here's a very difficult 30-second challenge and the goal is right after that. It's like I was expecting a lot more, but they kind of know when to stop testing you. It's like, okay, you've already proven you can do this. You're allowed to leave now. It's not like now do it the harder way. Now do it the very hard way. They like to be conservative with how much they reuse ideas, and I really respect that.
Mm. It does help pad out the number.
It really does.
Small bite-sized levels all the time.
It does,
It's kind of the approach they took with the shrines in Breath of the Wild. Like, here is a standalone bite-sized challenge.
They feel like about half the size of a Mario 1 level. I don't know if I'm being too exaggerating with that.
I mean, it depends on the stage. There are definitely some that are more expansive, but a lot of them are just like little quick bites. And you're right. I mean, it does help keep things varied. Like, there are a few ideas that sort of resurface. Like the giant world, I think, is a good way to sort of recontextualize previous challenges, such as the levels where, you know, the water rises and falls and there's a fish trying to jump.
Yeah, Big like, Bertha, I believe.
Yeah. Like that changes when you get to giant world and you get like a different take on it, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, each level is kind of built around – from a design standpoint, it feels like they're built around one or two ideas and they just laser focus on that and then it's you beat the level, and you're on to the next idea.
Those ideas don't recur too often.
Not very often.
Sometimes you'll see variants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's you know, like – a pipe maze or the Korobo shoe level or like one of the worlds in stage in World 4, the stages in World 4, the giant world, is like the same level with two different scales. There's like the small version of it, the normal sized version of it, and then you go through a door and you're like in the backside where everything's big. It's
and
like
they
the same
that
level
in,
giant.
Mario 64 also had the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, every level in this game has a very strong thesis, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like any level is just like, here's some platforms we don't know. I feel like every level has like a way to sum it up. Like you have to do X and Y while this is happening. I feel they really thought out like every level needs to have a point. It can't just be random things floating around to disturb Mario. But there are lots of changes to the Mario formula. And one of the biggest ones that I think is something that we take for granted is bouncing. Because bouncing off of enemies was in Mario 1, but it was mainly just to bounce onto the next enemy. You got like a tiny boost. But this game, when you bounce off an enemy, you jump like 3 times higher into the air than you normally do, or maybe 2 times. And strategically bouncing off enemies is a new technique in this game that eventually becomes necessary to progress.
Yeah, it's a matter of timing, though. It's not like you jump on an enemy and, whoa, you springboard.
You hit the A button again.
You have to press jump at just the right time.
Yeah. And controlled bouncing, eventually, like I said, it becomes vital. And this would remain an element of the series for the 2D games, like this important controlled bouncing. Go back to Mario 1 if you haven't played it in a while and you realize like, wow, I don't get any air off these Koopas. Like I'm not jumping off a Koopa onto a platform. platform that often.
Yeah, I think it was a magical moment for me where I felt the like boing, like, oh, wait, I'm jumping higher. If I hold down the jump button, could I hit the next thing that's within jumping distance? Like, I think the first time that hit me was in one of the first or second worlds of the second stage with the brick
worlds and stages.
All right, look. The second stage of the second world with the brick-covered little Goombas. When I jumped on one of them, like, oh, hey, I'm really flying up. There's another one over there. Can I hit it? All right, can I hit the third one? And it was magical.
It's one of those things when I see people playing and they're not doing that off of every enemy, I start to get, like, upset. Like, what are you doing?
It's like, aren't you holding down the B button all the time?
Yeah, that too. It's like when I try to – it's like, no, you always hold the B button in.
I don't think it's a coincidence that this concept, this mechanic debuted in the same game where you also gained the ability to control your – descent, your rate of fall.
Yeah.
And that's with a power-up, so you can't always do it. But if you have that right power-up, then you get great hang time and great control, and you can really harness that to boost your life count. There was I think World 1-2 or 1-3 where there's an infinite number of Goombas coming out of pipes.
Yeah, spilling down hills.
If you get the timing on that right, you can basically crank up your life count by just hopping on those guys. And by the time you run out of steam, you've already racked up like 3 or 4 extra lives.
Wow, lots of places like that.
Yeah, it's 1-2. I never tried that. Man, I should have done that.
It's really cool.
You never heard of it?
No, I never did that for free lives.
God, first the wizard. Now you guys don't know the big secret.
I knew it. It was in the strategy guide, and they called the level Rolling Hills and Goomba Spills because I read that strategy guide 9 million times.
There you go. Yeah.
Other changes in this game. There's a lot they're doing new in this game. So we have a world map. Levels are numbered, but you don't necessarily have to progress in a linear order. Instead, you move around on a board game style map with secrets and shortcuts and mini games and wandering encounters. Very different for the series. I believe in Mario 2, your progress was represented by nodes on like a page. Like there was like 4 nodes and it would show you. So they were moving in this direction, but this is more like a board game kind of thing. You're not rolling dice, but you're moving between nodes with different sort of challenges and different sorts of activities on them itself. And that was a very new thing. And I think I don't know if this is the first game to do this. Can anyone think of another precedent? I was trying to figure it out. I was like, Adventure Island? No. Adventure Island 2 kind of did that. That was
not really. But it's clearly inspired by like RPGs and stuff.
Yeah,
Zelda
for sure.
2 had the overworld. And
Bionic Commando.
Yeah. That was also 88. Mm-hmm.
It was before Mario, though.
But
it
they
was
were,
like May or so.
They were developed concurrently.
I'm not going to say like, Nintendo was like, oh, yes, Capcom. What a great idea.
It could have been one of those Miyamoto moments. It's like, I play Bionic Commando. I'm throwing all this away. We must make our game more like this. Put Hitler in it.
Use your bionic arm and flip the tea table.
I did read – I read this article on the making of Super Mario 3, which is more just a coalescing of a bunch of quotes from other things. But they definitely mentioned the nice way of putting it was Miyamoto was a perfectionist, and the less nice way was saying he'd throw out months of work because he had a new idea, and I could see him doing that late in it, I suppose. But
I
just thought of precedent actually.
Oh,
From 1986, Ninja Kid by Tosei and Bandai had a world map that you moved through to access your levels. The levels would be placed randomly.
Interesting.
And it wasn't like a line by line kind of movement, but it was pretty much the same concept where you had to like beat certain stages and then make your way to the finale.
Oh, but wasn't that taken from Dragon Buster?
Was it?
Maybe. I forget when it came out.
We're all trying to one-up each other.
Not me. I'm hanging back here. That world map offered up so many new things for the Mario series, at least, because you didn't have to beat every stage anymore.
No,
had the choice of going in the order you wanted, and it gave them way more chances to hide secrets and to also face not randomized enemies, but like the Hammer Brothers on the stage were – they were either farther away or closer, or you could also make them go to sleep. And you even got to see, you know, who beat what. It was even cooler in the two-player mode if you were playing with like a sibling like I would sometimes of like – oh, you couldn't beat 1-4. Well, I beat it, and now there's an M on it instead of an L, so I beat it first. Ha-ha.
L is for loser. Go to hell.
Yeah, two-player stuff was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not just alternating. Well, I mean, it was, but you could both be on the map. And
it's true, and Ray brought that up, and there's a built-in – really cool – a built-in version of Mario Brothers in this game because – so to proceed this, we have to talk about the goal challenges in that whenever you beat a stage, there's a roulette wheel sort of at the end or a roulette box. You either get a mushroom card, a fire flower card, or a star card. Ideally, you want to get 3 star cards and you'll get a 5-up. But if you get any other matching cards, you'll get more than a 1-up for collecting 3. But if you're playing 2-player, you can actually fight the other player or be friendly and trade cards with them. But most of the time, you would just steal their cards and try to kill them in that little mini game.
I never even thought of being friendly or sharing cards.
No. No one's friendly.
It's like, can I have the flower cards? Like, no, I'm taking all of your cards and I'm pushing you into a spiny.
These
goodbye.
Are my cards.
Yeah. So, and I mean, that was a really cool built-in thing. It was, I mean, it's not like the entire Mario Brothers game. It's essentially just one level that you play with somebody. But that's a really interesting mechanic that most people aren't going to even do, you know, with a 2-player game or probably won't even find really.
Well, I love the music of it too, like da 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 da. Like
it's like the Hammer Brothers theme, right? Mm-hmm. That they use, so other stuff that's new in this game, we have auto-scrolling levels for the first time, which a lot of people really, really hate. I don't know how you guys feel about them. I know a lot of people, I'm fine with them. I think it's an interesting challenge, but I know a lot of people are just like, let me decide when to scroll, please.
As a kid, I didn't like them, but that was my first time playing them. As an adult now, I was like, oh, I get these now. It's cool.
I mean, I never, when I played a lot of Mario Maker and made stuff, I never made an auto-scrolling level. How do you feel about auto-scrolling levels, Jeremy?
I'm not in love with them. I mean, I think they work here because the levels are so brief that they don't have time to start to grate on you.
It's true,
but they are very memorization based. Mm-hmm. Like you need to know when to jump and like which path to take in order to get the most coins and so on and so forth. Like where enemies are going to appear. So to me, they're less interesting than more like player controlled stages, but they're fine in moderation.
I think I really hated just the idea of scrolling stages until Yoshi's Island. When I played Yoshi's Island, I was like, well, I do like these, so I guess there are some good auto-scrolling stages. But like even the year before, minecart stages, which are also auto-scrolling but of a different shade, like I really hated them.
Those used to be so ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. What happened to the great mining craze? Did it die out with 2D games?
I mean, it was a big deal in Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. They're like, no, we still got minecart stages. We're doing it.
Those were fun, though.
It's more like a threat than a promise.
We'll bring them back. Don't make us bring them back. And in this game, we have 7 semi-distinct bosses. We, of course, have the Koopa Kids. And we have
Koopa
Bowser.
Koopalings.
I think they're like, it's interchangeable.
I guess.
I'm pretty sure it's interchangeable.
I think they are officially Koopalings.
I think Koopalings was a later addition, so we don't think they're actually Bowser's children because they're not.
Mm-hmm. No, of course not.
They're
why
like
would they be?
Bowser's nephews or something.
Sure. Yeah, right. So Bowser has a sister or a brother.
Well,
maybe. I don't know.
My head canon on that.
Doug Bowser.
My headcanon on that is that K-Mac just made them and that they're just magically produced clones.
That's horrible.
If you will. And so,
no wonder they're so mad all the time.
I mean, clearly Bowser has access to magic. So just to magically create more Koopalings or perhaps they're like upgraded Koopa Troopers. Perhaps they were
Let me tell you about my parthenogenesis theory of Koopa propagation.
Well, you see, they were exposed to the ooze, of course, and they became mutant ninja Koopas. I guess. Is that how it works?
I loved all the Koopalings.
Oh, I still love them.
I love them. It made me very sad to see them disappear in the mid-90s and then in the early 2000s to see Bowser Jr. just appear and pretend there were never other Koopa Kids.
Yeah, that never happened. Like, why were they ashamed? I mean,
but now there's no escape from them.
I love that.
Half the racers in Mario Kart 8 are Koopa Kids.
I don't want to escape them. Bury me in Koopa Kids.
Bury me with Koopa Kids.
Oh crap, what was I going to say? Oh yeah, what I really liked about the Koopalings then and now is the fact that they were given either like really dated names in the English localization or really like obscure, very sort of the time references, like Morton Downey Jr. reference.
That was a reference.
What kid understands that reference in the year of our Lord 2017?
There are basically 2 years when that reference could work, and that game landed within those 2 years. But like,
and like even at the time, I was like, what is Wendy O. Koopa a reference to?
All right, Wendy O. Williams. I guess we can go through all of them. Larry, people thought it was Larry King for a while, but somebody interviewed the localizer.
It's actually Larry David.
It's not Larry. Larry David. But just like he looked like a Larry, so I named him Larry. That was the thought process. And Larry's okay. My favorite. I don't know why. I've got a little plush Larry. I think he's the cutest one. Morton Downey Koopa. Wait, Morton Downey Koopa. Morton Koopa Jr. is named after Morton Downey Jr. And he was a talk show host.
Okay, so that kills your theory that K-Mac created them, because there is a Morton Koopa someplace. If he is the junior, there is a Morton Koopa someplace.
Mm. Mm. Darn it.
Chew on
the localizers ruined that. We should start a petition or something.
Yeah, so, yeah. I was going to say that's not canon, but that's still his name now.
That is his name.
So Wendy O. Koopa, Wendy O. Williams from... Yeah, Wendy O. Williams from the punk band The Plasmatics, Ludwig von Koopa, of course, Beethoven.
Yeah, that's the only one that's like a universal reference.
Yeah, Roy Koopa, Roy Orbison, because of the sunglasses.
That's somewhat less esoteric.
I like that.
Lemmy and Iggy, of course, Lemmy, last Motor name I forget.
Kilmeister.
Kilmeister, well, awesome name.
Great name.
And Iggy Pop. Lemmy, he's dead, right?
Yeah,
he is.
He recently died.
So, Bob's still hanging in
and
there.
And even there, we get progressive rock in Mario because he was a founding member of Hawkwind.
Iggy Pop has like a 90-year-old's head but like a ripped 23-year-old's body. I don't know how it works, but heroin.
Kind of like Carrot Top.
Heroin plus steroids maybe. Who knows?
Hey, side note, don't forget Boo Diddley.
That's right, Ray. I wasn't sure if I dreamed that, but Boo Diddley. And My insane theory that I've trotted out before is, okay, number one question, was Bowser known as Bowser in Mario 1 or was he the Koopa King?
I think so. I think in the movie, I think Bowser King of the Koopas.
I think he was Bowser in the movie.
Yeah.
Because it's very
Japan,
convenient.
He was always Bowser.
In that Bowser is a member of Sha-Na-Na, which actually works incredibly well with this this kind of musical theming. Boo Diddley, all the Koopa kids.
I mean,
except for Morton Downey Koopa.
Miyamoto is famously a music dork. Like, he likes American music a lot. I would not be shocked. The Sha-Na-Na, like, they're a cover band. They don't do originals.
Is he known as Bowser in Japan? I forget the etymology.
No.
Yeah.
He's Koopa.
Koopa, yeah. Mm. So, yeah, this is all American. And I think Bowser is just like a dog's name or something, maybe. I don't know.
But he's also an executive at Nintendo now.
I like talking about this for ages, by the way. This is my favorite topic.
They very quickly clipped all those names. Like, Morton isn't Morton Down, isn't Morton Koopa Jr. He's just Morton Koopa now.
Oh, they got rid of the Jr.?
Oh, no. So maybe that is canon.
Destroys the theory.
So Boo Diddleys are just boos and so on and so forth.
Though also, I had read that they based the designs of the Koopa Kids on members of the team. Like they were kind of caricatures of team members on the game. There was also a personal – speaking of booze, like the – it actually is not as funny a story as I think they thought it was, but that the Boo acting scary when you turn around and then covering its face, they say it was based on Tezuka's wife, who was known as very like quiet and
nice.
Oh,
it was
nice.
Tezuka's wife. Okay.
And then she was seen as very quiet and nice, except he had one day been – or he had been spending too long at the office for too long, and then he came home and she like yelled at him about it. He's like, oh, boy, this is your real face. I was like, well, what? It's an odd story of angry spouse. Like, angry spouse.
Her justified rage created an enemy, but it's funny.
This workaholism started and inspired us.
Boo has a feminine name in Japan. Boos are called Teresa in Japan, so that is just an odd name. I guess I could probably look it up, but I'm sure
Birdo is Catherine.
So it's like, what? I don't know where that came from. Who
just
knows?
One of those
but so I think we have to do some more research or visit Ancestry.com to find out where the Koopa Kids came from. So while we're doing that, here's a fun break.
If you pay careful attention to how fast I talk while on Retronauts, you'd probably guess that I drink a lot of coffee. And if so, you guessed correctly. In fact, I need it to live. But for me, coffee isn't just a convenient caffeine source, it's gotta taste good too. That said, after consuming 2 whole bags of the stuff recently, I can safely recommend Red Rooster Coffee. Red Rooster Coffee offers a unique and fun subscription service with options to have coffee delivered directly to your door every 2 to 4 weeks. Choose from a variety of options, including their delicious organic blends, their organic single origins, or the exciting Microlot series. Red Rooster roasts their beans the same day they ship, meaning you'll have the freshest coffee possible. And Red Rooster has won numerous awards for their coffee, including a Good Food Award and Golden Bean Awards, as well as having coffee listed in the top 10 coffees of the year by Coffee Review 2 years running. To receive your first Red Rooster coffee subscription delivery for free, go to redrooster.coffee/retro and use the coupon code FREERETRO. That's one shipment of the freshest, highest quality coffee in the world delivered to your door for free. There's no commitment to continue, and you can cancel anytime. Red Rooster is so confident that you'll love their coffee, the first delivery is free. As someone with a very specific, and some would say unemployable, set of skills, I know firsthand the endless pain of finding a new job. Searching for new openings, crafting tailor-made cover letters, and then sending resumes out into the void, hoping you'll at the very least get some sort of response. Thankfully, there's now a much better way than taking the shotgun approach to Craigslist. By visiting Dice.com or using Dice's mobile app, you can discover what your skills are worth and receive salary estimates based on your specific skill set and location. And if you're looking to earn more, Dice can tell you which skills bring home the most bank. Dice has been connecting tech pros with job opportunities for over 20 years. Now they're a full-blown career hub delivering the tools and resources you need to manage your career. Dice will let you browse over 70,000 tech jobs ranging from software development, UX, and project management, and give you a tremendous amount of insight around the job market about which skills are hot and which ones are cooling off. And with Dice, you can also check out salary reports and tools to fully understand how you stack up. To find out more, visit dice.com/canyouhackit. That's dice.com/canyouhackit. Hack your career with Dice.
Hey, listen up.
I'm Dog the Bounty Hunter.
And I'm his wife, Beth, of course.
And we're looking for trouble. My wife, Beth, and I have a brand new podcast called Dog and Beth Looking for Trouble.
Which, by the way, you are always looking for trouble.
You're
in trouble, whichever the case
is. No, I'm always getting you out of trouble. Who are we after?
Everybody.
Politicians.
Celebrities.
We're telling on all of you.
Everybody.
It's the hunt is on.
Telling it like it is.
Dog and Beth Looking for Trouble. We'll be able to talk to our fans a lot closer than we could on television.
Join us on a backseat ride-along every Tuesday starting in July.
Be sure to tune in
at podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
From the classic Nintendo video game, it's the adventures of Super Mario Bros. 3.
I better tell the princess!
The complete 26-episode collection, now available on a 3DVD box set.
Don't worry, my mushroom pal.
King Koopa is back.
Me? Never.
And this time, he's brought the Koopa kids.
I love being a Koopa!
So it's up to Mario, Luigi, and Princess Toadstool to save the day.
We can fix that.
Special features include the series backstory, character and concept art, and more.
Get those Goombas back in that cage!
The Adventures of Super Mario Bros. 3, now on DVD.
Hey, if you're listening to this podcast, thanks. You're rad. And you can make your listening experience even more rad by checking out the show on the new and improved Podcast One app. It offers built-in community options and even the ability to watch some podcasts in 360-degree video form, including some upcoming Retronauts episodes. That's the closest you can get to sitting in the studio with us without having to worry about a restraining order. So check out the Podcast One app on iOS or Android, why don't you?
Let me tell you about Pete, who loved hockey and always wanted to play in the NHL. Pete played since he was 3 and begged his mom to let him stay on the ice. Why, some nights, he even slept in his hockey skates. Pete practiced and practiced until one day. When he was 47, Pete realized he just wasn't that good, so he threw his skates in the trash. But then he heard how GEICO, proud partner of the NHL, could save him money on car insurance. So he switched and saved a bunch. So it all worked out.
So we're back, and before I get started, if you heard ads and no longer want to hear ads on Retronauts, just go to patreon.com/retronauts. And for $3 a month, if you sign up, you will get every podcast a week ahead of time and at a higher bitrate. And you get a private RSS feed that works with any podcast app or device that will just send our podcast directly to you. So I understand some people don't like ads and that we offer a way to not get the ads in our podcast. But if you want to hear the podcast for free and don't mind ad, that's fine as well. I just want to throw that out there. So let's get started with talking more about Mario 3. And we left off talking about some of the things the game did new. And they aren't formally called ghost houses yet, but there are these like ghost house style levels in Mario 3. They're working towards the ghost houses in Super Mario World that would just be based around ghosts and ghost style enemies. But there are some of these like little fortresses that are really they feel like an evolution of the sort of maze style Bowser levels in Mario 1, where they're more of like a navigation challenge than just getting to the end. They're more of like figure out how to get to the end, like which doors will get you there, which maybe you go a different direction than you think you're supposed to go, things like that. I feel like they're really playing with what a 2D platforming level could be.
I hate those more than auto-scrollers. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, the one I really dislike is the one in the in World 3 where it's like, here are 34 doors. All but one of them will dump you into the water. And I always forget which door it is. I don't know why I haven't memorized it by now. I probably played that level like 50,000 times by now.
Yeah, they were tricksy, definitely. You know, actually, I noticed, too, from going from one – if you go just from one to three, the big difference was having, like, water indoors or having – like, there were either – in one, there were, like, either underwater stages or not underwater, but having, like – pools of water you could go in and then hop out of into the ground.
That's true,
That was a bit different.
Yeah. A mix of land and water. Another level type, which had never happened before in a Mario game, are airships. Instead of every level, final level taking place in a castle, which was traditionally what happened in Mario 1, these would be the airships of the Koopalings. Mm. And the cool part about this – well, I guess it's uncool if you die. The cool part about this is if you die, the airship can move across the map, potentially behind levels you haven't finished yet. And I don't know. When I play Mario 3, I actually just do finish every level to get the 1-ups and get all the nice M's on the screen. But if you just want to rush to the airship, it's possible the airship could fly away behind a level and you have to beat that level to access the final level again, which is a really cool idea.
I like that thunderclap that kind of happens when it moves.
Oh, yeah.
You only hear it because you died and it's moving, but still just hearing that like clack.
And the screen flashes or something, mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
And the scrolling stages were like – those were really fun and it was a great way to do a slightly different version of the scrolling stages, like getting the up and down of a ship except it's in the air. And I always remember even in the first level, like you have just cannons everywhere shooting at you. But then they kind of – there's at least one I remember a cannonball will go down but then will like kind of then just go straight because the screen is moving.
Yeah, that's right.
The exact same way.
Yeah, like most of the enemies on these airships are just bullets and cannonballs being fired at you. There are those really annoying enemies that throw the wrenches. I don't know what they're called, but they're
not Monty Moles.
No, I hate them because those wrenches are so small and they always end up in the worst places.
I think their name is Rocky.
Rocky. Mm. It could be, yeah.
Those guys are jerks though. And they keep popping back up even when you're like, all right, I killed you. And they're like, nope, I'm still – another one appeared right now.
There's a whole family under me. Get ready. Yeah, I mean these are auto-scrolling and I didn't measure this in any way, but these feel like they scroll slower than the other auto-scrolling stages because it's like, I just want to get past these bullets. Move me. Keep moving. But it moves slow and it, like Henry says, it bobs up and down. And they do a lot. They do a lot with this idea. Like no airships feel alike. And like one of them, you basically have to move through like a gauntlet of like there's just cannons in like a row. You have to like go through them very strategically in order to not get hit.
Well, and those airships, replaying it, it reminded me of how New Super Mario Brothers had like rewritten my brain on these things because I got to the end and here's the pipe. And I was like, oh, well, time to get that invisible power up that's probably right over. Oh, wait, yeah, they don't do that.
You had to carry it with you, Henry. And speaking of power-ups, let's go over what the power-ups are in Mario 3. Well, of course, we have the trilogy of power-ups from Mario 1, of course, the Mushroom, the Fire Flower, and the Starman. And they all do the same things they do. I probably don't need to tell you what they do if you have played a video game before.
Though I liked the little differences with them. Only in the NES version and all the remakes, they stopped doing it. But I guess it was just a technical limitation. Your clothes do not turn white and red when you become Fire Mario.
That's right.
You are fiery. You are orange. As orange as our president. But it was something they didn't do in the remake. So I think it was just they couldn't do it. They couldn't just displayed those colors on screen as Mario.
That part of those colors were not in the palette of whatever they were doing, I guess, however that works.
And then when you're Star Mario, you do friggin' somersaults in the air. You don't just do regular jump.
That's so great. The somersaults are a nice touch. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to do that. It just like, look how awesome he is. He's going to like friggin' do somersaults. He's so powerful.
There's a ton of things they didn't have to do, but they did.
Yeah, I mean that really is like the mission statement of this game. Like, we don't have to put all this stuff in, but we're going to.
Well, it was just extra work to draw a new sprite of him, you know, tucked in for the spin instead of everybody would have been fine if it was just the same jumping animation, but your colors changed.
Yeah, it was a really nice surprise when you first get that first star.
Yeah, I mean, it really feels like a Metroid reference because you're invincible when you do that spinning jump.
I never thought of it like that.
So, and another thing that I really like, something I didn't realize until I recently played the Famicom version of the game, is that for the US version, they changed power downs. Mm. So when you're hit, after you get a one-up or the power mushroom, the super mushroom, in the Famicom version, it works just like Super Mario Brothers 1, where a single hit when you have the fire flower, a single hit takes you down to Tiny Mario. But in the American version, if you have a fire flower or another power-up, you just lose that power-up, but you still stay super, which makes a very different game. It makes it easier.
And it's odd, especially in this era, Jeremy, that a game would be made easier for Americans. Usually it was the other way around because of the rental market. It's like, no, you will not beat this game in 3 days. We will crush you. You will memorize every part of it. But yeah, in Mario World, it does follow the Japanese Mario 3's power-down rules, where if you are Fire Mario or Cape Mario, you get hit once, you're small. You don't go back to big. But yeah, that is an important change. I'm glad you pointed that out. But the star of the show for Mario 3 is the Raccoon Leaf, because it changed the game for platformers. Because primarily, if you had a side-scrolling level – I mean, sorry, previously when you had a side-scrolling level in most games, almost every game, the top of the screen was the top of the screen. There was no – that was basically the ceiling. There was nothing above that. Mario 3 changed that around, where it's like, once you get this leaf, you can explore beyond what you see on the TV screen. There's stuff going on above that potentially, which that – I mean, as basic of an idea that sounds, like that was kind of new. I'm going to say entirely new for me, at least, for a level that scrolled left to right, that there are things happening above where the TV was showing me.
Well, I think it's good that those kind of levels are cohesive now, because in Mario 1, it's just like you have to climb a vine and then do a screen transition to some other sub-level.
You're in like Cloud World or whatever suddenly.
No, I still liked in the first Mario game that like the ceiling was – if you went above the ceiling, then you were running through the numbers.
Yeah.
But in the World 1-1 – Stage 1-1 teaches you everything about flying so well just through level design. They give you that – they immediately teach you that you can now kick the shell over. It's not just jumping on the shell and sending it flying. Then you get the leaf and they give you a bunch of Goombas in front of you to – maybe try smacking with your tail. Right. And then once you've cleared the runway, they give you the perfect thing like – run to the end of this and jump. Hey, look at these coins. Keep going up for these coins. You might see something cool if you keep going up.
It's really perfect design, and it's like that clicked with me as a kid. I didn't need to be told, like, it was just in front of me and I figured it out. It's like they go over a lot of the basic changes of this game really up front in that first level.
And when you get to the end, when you get to the second secret in the air part and get to the coins with the number 3, you're like, wow, this is so awesome.
It does feel like them patting themselves on the back, like, yes, you can fly now, and we made a third game. We are so great. So yeah, I mean, this is the star of the show. This was why it was on the front cover. It was a big deal that Mario could fly. Like, this was not a normal thing for this kind of game. And you have to put yourself back to 1990 to really remember that. I mean, we take it for granted again, and this was like a really important new thing for us. But moving on to other power-ups, we have the frog suit, which is just absolute dog shit on land. I hate this thing, but it will help you. What's that, Ray?
By design, dude.
By design, yeah. It's like
it's a frog.
Frogs are, of course, they work well in water. I mean, this thing kicks ass underwater, and there are some levels I hold on to the frog suit for just to get past levels, because I think the swimming levels in Mario 3 are some of the more brutal levels, even more than Mario 1.
So should we explain why the frog suit is so great underwater?
Because you don't do like the sort of the balloon fight style, you know, swimming. You just basically push up, down, left, and right to move in those directions. Mm-hmm. And holding in the A button will let you just move in that one direction. So you can move not in a – what is that? A parabola or something? What is the curve? Is that that's not a parabola? I don't know. But the way Mario swims naturally, where you like go up a little and then you float down, you go up a little and you float back down.
Yeah, I guess it's a parabola.
Yeah, it's a parabola. I don't do math here, but
and it made it way easier to avoid, you know, both like those static jellyfish and the bloopers with the tail of bloopers behind them.
I hate those bastards. And I think in this game, I didn't try when I replayed the game, but I'm pretty sure you can use the frog suit to go into certain pipes with currents coming out of them for like really, really good treasures and things like that.
I also think of Frog Mario because it was the only issue of the Super Mario 3 comic book I had when Valiant Comics, they got the big Nintendo license in America to do the Nintendo comic book system. Nintendo comic system.
I'm glad they stopped that naming scheme. It's like Nintendo serial system, Nintendo comic system.
And so it launched alongside the Game Boy. So the biggest books were the Game Boy comic books, but they also had a Super Mario 3 book. And in one storyline, Mario goes underwater in his frog suit and a big Bertha falls in love with him because she thinks he's a frog man. And also in that story, he eats a giant meatball and has a bad stomach ache.
So this is supposed to teach the kids something, I guess? Like, interspecies love is wrong and don't overeat.
It was basically a ripoff of that part in the Sword in the Stone where the squirrel falls in love with the kids and thinks he's a squirrel.
I see. Well, Valiant, you tried. Or maybe you didn't. I didn't like those comics as a kid.
They look ugly. Like, when you compare them to, say, Kotabe's official art, they're like, boy, you guys put a little off-brand.
Especially
here,
the manga that was in the Nintendo
Mario
Power.
Mario-kun?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mario-kun's great, but the Charlie Nozawa, who did the manga for Nintendo Power.
Japanese artists are better than American ones, though.
Always. Come on. I mean,
no, I don't mean that.
I salute the Japanese flag every morning, of course. That other power-up we have here is the Tanuki suit, which would teach American children what a Tanuki was, kind of. I guess
that's how we learned about testicles.
Mario did not have any testicle-based abilities in this game. But this is one of the more Japanese things in Mario 3. Like, I don't think anyone in 1990 in America knew what a Tanuki was. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not spelled in the way that it's localized today or transliterated today. But
I think they localized it for Mario phonetically because kids wouldn't know, like,
you
should be ooh, but if you spell it, read it out
as today would know
O-O,
that line over a U would like, mean a long one.
Listen, these kids eat Fruit Loops. They know what double O's mean. So
we're all for Tanuki.
You're banned from saying that again.
I love Tanuki Mario, so Raccoon Mario and Tanuki Mario are both my favorites, like aesthetically, power-ups they ever had. And I failed to save the exact quote, but I did look this up. Like, Miyamoto said he was happy the Tanuki got to stay in and the Tanuki power-up came over because at first he thought it wasn't going to because it was so Japanese. It seemed like he was implying he thought maybe Nintendo of America would ask them to change it in localization. I mean, you turn into a Buddhist, like a statue.
Yeah, Jizo. It's kind of
Jizo.
A little weird. I mean, not weird, but just like – it doesn't make sense if you don't know the history.
Yeah.
I mean, Buddhists in India call this figure a different name, of course. But I was looking up information about Jizo. It was the first time I realized like what this figure was. And apparently he's the guardian of children and children who died before their parents, like miscarried children. So that's fun.
Here's something. I mean, this is kind of a little bit of a digression.
Oh, sure.
But something Henry mentioned earlier about the little line of like the bloopers with the little line of other bloopers behind them.
Yeah.
And then you also have the Goombas, the flying Paragoombas that release the baby Goombas. And then Bowser has the Koopalings.
So this is the first baby mania in Mario.
I'm wondering if like between, you know, like Mario 1 and 3, like a lot of the development team started to have kids because they would have all kind of been around, you know, late like 20s, early 30s. Yeah. Like the right age to start having kids. So
and they see
and
children.
Then you have like the statue that protects, you know, children who lose their parents.
True. Yeah. I mean, I guess
I'm wondering if there's something there.
I guess they saw children as annoying things that slow you down. hurt adults.
I could see after the hit of the Famicom, they probably were just like, you know what, it is time to settle down.
Yeah.
I should have kids.
Pop them out.
They could have had kids on the mind. You know, maybe not all negative emotions.
I was just trying to make a joke. But
the Tanuki reminds me of multiple things I've read in interviews where they sneak in Japanese – well, not sneak in, but they retain Japanese-style things for other releases. They talked about it too in this amazing Iwata ass with the original designers of the Game & Watch and how the Octopus Game & Watch looks exactly like the way manga artists have drawn well, even before manga have drawn octopus faces. Like it is the stereotypical octopus face.
You see those masks at like Japanese festivals too, those octopus masks.
And also in more recently in Super Mario 3D World, when they put in the Lucky Cat stuff in it, I read in their what ass, so like, well, first we thought, well, Americans know what that is, or will people outside Japan and China know what the Lucky Cat is? But they're like, it's fun. Who cares? Like,
yeah, and it should be mentioned that this power, so you hit down in B as a Tanuki. So Tanuki Mario has Raccoon Mario's powers. He can flip his tail. He can fly for a brief period of time. But hitting down in B turns you into that statue. And I find this to be a fairly useless power. I just like how Tanuki Mario looks.
No, the Jizo is great. It can destroy things that can't normally
be destroyed.
It can,
yeah. You can
kill
useful.
Invincible elements of the stage.
I just find it I don't know. I just don't find it that useful in what I do with the game.
It also kind of predates the butt stomp ability because jump up in the air and then press down and B, you turn into the statue and it plummets and crushes whatever it
is. So
hits.
It's like the Buddhist butt stomp. Basically.
It is a proto butt stomp. And when they added the Tanuki suit to Super Mario 3D Land, when they finally brought it back in 2011 – They added that power up, but only for like the special Tanuki suit that you get in the second wave of the game.
Oh, no wonder I didn't play that part of the game. I know it's the best part.
You have a bandana on in that version, and they had to make the rule of like if you can transform into this, then it can kill anything in that game too. Like, oh, so it can kill the giant snakes that'll try to bite you. Like, yeah, okay, they can. And boy, Bob, if you haven't played that part of 3D Land, you haven't really
the
played 3D
The first part was too
Land.
Boring for me to like, finish. I'm sorry.
Then you're wrong.
Okay.
It's not too boring.
I'm okay with being wrong. I'm big enough to admit that I'm wrong.
But the second half is the real game that you would love.
I'll
I'm
get
sure
to it. I have it digitally and it's fine. I will play it eventually.
Fine.
But we should mention, like, why is a Tanuki turning into a statue? Well, in Japanese mythology, Tanuki are these like trickster animals with magical powers who can transform into things. I totally recommend the Ghibli movie Pompoko. It is a beautiful movie that made me cry. I never thought a movie with incredibly well-rendered animal testicles would make me cry, but it happens in Pompoko.
Those scrotums are very well done by Takahata and his team.
It's not as gross as it sounds, believe me.
No.
It's about animals versus man, and I'm rooting for the animals, frankly. Mm-hmm. And the last power up is OP, folks. It's the hammer suit, the legendary hammer suit that seemed like a lie when people would tell you about it without reading the strategy. You're like, no, you can't turn into a hammer, brother. Go ahead.
Now, here's also where Mario gets the most Mega Man he's ever been.
That's true.
He takes the power of an enemy.
He killed a hammer brother and crawled into a shell. And this is, I mean, so. Hammer Brothers suit, the only drawback is you can't slide, which is an odd drawback. But
well, I read a reason for that. The reasoning would be that – so you can't slide, but if you're on a slope and you wanted to block a fireball, they wanted to give you the option to do that of sliding down a slope. So
cool. Interesting.
By ducking, you get into the invincible block mode instead of sliding.
Yeah. So this, of course, you can throw hammers. Mario looks awesome. He gets like a tan when he wears it. And this is a very well hidden item. There are only 5 available in the game. 2 of those are in mushroom houses, which I didn't mention before. Those are – you go into a mushroom house. There are 3 treasure chests. You open one and get that item. So there are 2 times you can get it at random, mm-hmm. 3 times really well hidden in levels. So this is an item that like once you have it, you have too much anxiety to be happy about keeping it. Like somebody's going to hit me. I want to be Hammer Mario forever.
I think Hammer Mario is a great example of this game's ability to use scarcity to great effect.
Yeah.
Because the hammer – suit is so rare that it really feels special when you acquire it.
Yeah.
And there's just so much about this game that you only see it like once or twice.
Yes.
And so it really sticks on you. I mean, Korobo Shoe is the obvious example. But the Hammer Brothers suit is another great example because it's, you know, it's not restricted to a single level like the Korobo Shoe is. Mm. But, you know, it's still really hard to come by. And yeah, like you said, like when I get the Hammer Brothers suit, I kind of freak out.
I'm yes, like, it's like
I
too
can't
much.
Lose this. And so, of course, then I end up immediately losing it.
Yeah, that it gave me a lot of childhood anxiety too. That scarcity. The Tanuki suit too was not. It wasn't.
They're
it was,
all relatively
It was also
rare.
Pretty rare. So if I ever got it, I'd be like, man, it'd be cool to take it in the stage. What if I get hit? No. Oh,
yeah.
The Tanuki suit doesn't seem as special because it is kind of like just an amped up version of basic, you know, Mario 3 specific power.
But it's so much cuter.
It's the cutest one. He looks so fat and adorable in that Tanuki suit. I love it.
And then they based an anime on that called Serial Experiments Lane.
Oh, what? Wait, where's this coming from? Did I miss something?
She just – like the main character spends a lot of the series in like these teddy bear pajamas.
Oh, you're right. I watched that like 17 years ago and
a while.
I didn't like it.
It has been a while.
But Katabe's drawing of him was so cute. Just the one mid-run is just adorable.
It's a great drawing. All the production art for this is fantastic.
And they made him look super cute again when he came back in 3D Land.
I've seen those renders. I like it.
I think it made me sad that they turned away from the raccoon and the – Tanuki suit so much, and that after this game, and that they thought, no, we want a cape. And I like Cape Mario.
Cape Mario is fine. Cool. I mean, we talked a lot about it in the Mario World episode, but it's a skill based power up where it's like you must have skill to use as well. Where Raccoon Mario, it's like no, you run and then you just jam on a button and you're flying.
Yeah, though as a kid, I think to the wait, raccoons can fly, or what is this Tanuki thing? It kind of keyed into the whole, like, it is a stereotype, but the Japan's so crazy.
Whoa, he touches
thing.
A mushroom, weird.
I guess raccoons can fly in Japan, aren't they weird? Like that, it played into that too.
Yeah, I mean, once we found out where these games came from, that stereotype popped up. But one thing I didn't mention, and I did want to mention it now, is an added mechanic that, again, I think we forget about is that as with Mario 2, Mario can now hold and carry certain kinds of items, but every item he can carry either comes back to life and hurts him or dissolves. So I think they were worried about like technology getting in the way. Like we can't have him carry this all the way because what if there are too many sprites on the screen or what if these things don't interact the way we want them to? So everything you can hold has a finite time you can hold it before you have to let go. And you can bring shells and stuff into pipes, but they disappear. Mario World would be like you can carry anything anywhere. You can throw it up in the air and catch it. Like they would develop that idea much more in Mario World.
Yeah, but you still can't quite cheat in either game that much if you – I mean – I think that's part of why they made those things finite because you might be able to cheat that you may be able to go to an earlier level that you didn't do it and cheat all the way through it, and they didn't really want to deal with that, I think.
I like those blocks you can throw and how they teach you can throw them by you meet the enemy that picks them up and throws them. Yeah. And you're like, oh, I can throw these.
That guy's a jerk too. I think he's got a grudge or something. He looks unhappy.
And also the ice blocks that you can melt. Like there's a lot of different ways to interact with the stages in this game.
So other items we have are Karibo Shoe. Of course, that is the star of level 5-3. I think we all know which level to find that in. And that's it's basically a Goomba. Goomba in Japan is, by the way, a Kuribo, which they – for some reason, two of the items have enemy names in it that they didn't translate. I find odd. Maybe they just missed it or something. But Karibo Shoe is a Goomba shoe and – you get in it and you're like just a stomping death machine for an entire level. And there's an entire level built around using the shoe, which is great. Just
not just
one
a
idea.
Stomping death machine, but from, you know, from below, you're an invincible stomping death machine. So the shoe allows you to jump on those black pakun flowers.
Yeah.
So which would normally would be, you know, it's just like a carpet of death. You can just hop across it and it's no big deal.
Yeah. And it's so – but it also is super cute too, like with its wind-up toy aesthetic to it.
Mm. It's got like a little key in the side, like a little wind-up key.
And Mario just kind of peeks out over the top.
It's cute. So we have Jugem's Cloud and Jugem. Sorry, Ray? Tell me this ahead of time. Jugem's Cloud.
It's Chip.
It's a Chip. Jugem is actually Lakitu, and Jugem is a Japanese, I'm thinking of the word mythological tale or something like that, like Momotaro or something. What's the word I'm looking for?
Folklore.
Folklore. There you go. Yeah. This is not important though, but this allows you to skip past the level in the, on the world map. But if you die in the level that you skip to, you go back to where you originally started. So
not as useful as I would have liked it.
No, no.
Not like a P-Wing.
The P-Wings are great. I mean, P-Wing is just like infinite P-meter. Just fly over a level if it's too hard for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that with some of the airship levels if you just want to cheese it.
And some of the castle levels like have secrets and stuff that you can find.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I didn't do that with this playthrough, but I do remember that. So the anchor, of course, I never use it. But
I never used it until reading it in your notes. I was like, oh, yeah, that anchor. Yeah. I never used that thing.
So if you use it, it pins down the airship. So even if you die, it can't fly away. But if you just beat every stage, you don't have to worry about that. Hammer lets you break rocks on the world map. Another semi-useless item is the music box. It puts the Hammer Brothers to sleep on the world map.
Yeah,
and it plays a little – I like the little lullaby version of the Mario 1 theme it plays. It's really cute.
Yeah.
It's a nice callback.
But the though the hammer is actually very important in finding some secrets, like if you want in the – the water is world four. Nah,
world three. You can break a rock and access a canoe that will bring
get
you
get that good old canoe and just take your. It's so cool, and I also love that one because that's the Japanese world where the castle is on Japan.
Is it in Kyoto?
It's basically in Kyoto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's basically you're going to Nintendo's headquarters.
Mm.
And the whistle, of course, of which there are. Two in the game? Are there two or three?
There's at least three.
Yeah.
There's two in the first world.
Direct from Hyrule.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It plays the song that it plays when Link blows into it. And I believe it's like an ocarina or whatever.
And the hammer is straight from Zelda 2.
You're right. Yeah, that's true.
But those – yeah, I always get those first two and then I never need a – I rarely need the third one, so I don't remember where that one is.
Yeah.
Like, the first one is in 1-3 where you crouch on the white box and then you can go behind and go into the secret toad house.
You go backstage basically.
And then in the first fortress, you bring up your P-meter and fly to the top of the screen instead of going to fight Boomer. You then walk to the edge and go to the secret room to get
I mean, that crouching on white blocks thing to turn – to go behind the scenes of like the stage is such a strange and magical thing. Like when I was reading about how to get the whistle and I did it for the first time, I was like, oh my God, like I broke the game or I'm doing something special. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, this was basically put in there because there's no save game, no way to save your game in Mario 3. And it's a fairly large game. So you can if you just want to skip to a world, you can get these within the first 5 minutes of you playing. But also it lets you play it on a higher difficulty level because if you warp right to World 8 with 5 lives and 0 items, you are in for the hardest Mario 3 experience of your life. I mean, the ideal way to play this is to play every level so you have enough lives and items in order to take on World 8, which is very difficult. I can never do World 8 without having to play through everything first. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I don't think I ever beat World 8 without at least going through half the worlds and then whistling there as a kid. And then when I played through it on the GBA remake, that's when I just did every world that time.
Yeah, I mean, they let you save anywhere you wanted to, right, on the world map?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. So the music is fantastic. More music than a Mario game would have up to this point. It's reggae as hell. Like the main overworld theme, it has this like pokey reggae beat, and they have like authentic like timpani and like steel drum and stuff like that in this. Like they Koji Kondo worked really hard to make this a very like reggae style game, and it's such a unique sound for the Mario series. Although I mean we are in the what I would call earlier in Retronauts the Cave Mania era, where it's like everything's tropical and there's cavemen and dinosaurs and just a tropical vibe. You don't necessarily need cavemen or anything, but this is sort of falling into that era in the late 80s early 90s. But I love the music in this game. We get the first athletic Mario theme, which would be a trend from here on out, where you have an overworld theme, which you hear in most levels, but the athletic theme is in levels that are more complicated, that move faster, that scroll automatically, and those are always my favorite themes in any Mario game, I think, the athletic themes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when even I was a kid, I was kind of equating that music with steel drums. It's like very, very, very easy to think of that.
Yeah.
The same way, like, I used to think of really Mario music as, like, big band, and then they just sort of did that with 3D World. So
that's true, cool. Yeah. And we were, like...
So I love that.
Nintendo's been kind of brassy lately, haven't they?
Yeah, thank God.
I love it. I love it, though. But as I've been reiterating throughout this episode, like, variety is the main appeal of Mario 3. Like, every other game paled in comparison. Even great games with a lot going on. Like there was more going on in this game than I think like any platformer to date. I can't think of anything else that was as ambitious, had so much content. And that was due to the just the talent and the time they worked on it, yeah. and just like how important Mario was for Nintendo.
Yeah, after the success of Super Mario Brothers, I think they had a lot longer leash and they were able to make the choices of like, no, we're going to take as long as – we will take longer on this. We won't be – we won't cut as much stuff as we would before. Like we – if we like this – item, we're going to keep it in here. If we want to make this type of enemy, we'll make that type of enemy. And definitely the size and variety of it shows you how much they didn't cut or how many ideas they had and wanted to mess around with.
And just going more into the variety, I mean, we talked about how many like things are going on in this game, but just some like macro things. So like world themes, every world has a distinct feel and theme with different tile sets. I mean, like
– that means we can blame this game for why every other platformer from then on had the ice world and the desert world and the lava world.
And the water world too, and it has all of the things that would eventually become like the skeleton of every like of this kind of experience, where it's like you need to meet these themes in order to have a platformer, 2D or 3D. So enemies, we went over a lot of them more than any other Mario game. Just playing through it again, I'm like, oh, I forgot about this enemy and I forgot about this enemy. Like I forgot about the enemy, the candles where the flames come off the candles and chase you. Yeah. I'm like, I totally forgot about that.
The ghost floors.
Yeah. Like the little ghost bars.
Those floors. Yeah, those are awesome. I also, you know, there's the chain chomps and the flying chain chomps that explode in fireworks.
Yeah.
But I also love the little – the little piranha plants, little white piranha plants that are almost like baby – like puppies or just baby version of animals.
They're so cute.
They little hop after you like, oh, you're kind of close. Hop, hop, hop. Like they, it's adorable, though they're also like – they can be annoying in groups and they can be dropped on you too. And
Did we mention the angry sun?
The angry sun is a
childhood trauma.
You can kill him with a turtle shell, but he does come back. Yeah, like that is a great. I mean, like I didn't know what would happen in that level, and when the sun came down on me, I was freaking out.
And then you get to World 8, and you're like, "Well, I'm safe from the sun here because it's dark." But you're wrong. It's because there's the sun in pitch blackness.
Yes. It's the gray sun. He's back. This gritty reboot.
I liked when they would shock you with stages that weren't a numbered stage, but it'd be like the quicksand stage. Like, well, wait, this isn't doesn't have a number on it, but the stage's all the same.
Yeah, and like in World 5, you start out on the surface of the Mario planet. One of the stages is just a tower. You climb this tower, and then once you get to the top, you're in a new set of levels. You can see
Sky World.
Yes, you can see the other world map, really tiny, like in under you. It's really cool. Yeah.
It's so awesome, and getting the like. You're basically climbing the Tower of Babel into the sky.
to punish humanity for their hubris. And again, so this is a major element of just the variety of this game. Platforms. There are so many kinds of platforms. They just go crazy, like donut lifts and the platforms that act like seesaws and the platforms you get on, they follow like a little line pathway. Like they would develop a lot of these into different ideas in Mario World, but there are just so many kinds of platforms in this game. I can't remember. Are there springboards in Mario 3? I can't remember.
There's
for the
note blocks.
Note blocks, yes. And the way you bounce off of those is much more reliable and predictable than the awful springboards of Mario 1. I've always hated those. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you guys, but it's just like, is this going to be the jump where I go really high? Oh, it's not. Okay.
Even the note blocks are pretty tough, as I discovered when I made some levels with note blocks in Mario Maker, because people who don't know the series did not do well with that stage. I ended up changing it pretty considerably after letting my wife trial.
Too much negative feedback. And again, level variety, we mentioned this, but your goal may always feel the same, but no two levels feel alike. A few are kind of similar, but there's always enough new going on where it's like every level you don't think like, oh, this is just like blah, blah, blah. Even with the levels where the land is sinking and rising and Big Bertha is after you, there's different stuff happening in the few versions of that you see. So yeah, anything else about Mario 3 before we move on to our final Mario 3-related topic? I don't know if I missed anything. I think we've been pretty thorough.
I liked in – World 8 really was quite a gauntlet to face at the end of the game. You really felt like you earned the end of the game if you could get through all that. Like that you don't even get – You go through two maps before you even get to a numbered world, which just like shows you how much it's kicking your ass. Yeah. Like,
and you cross that bridge, and sometimes a hand comes out and grabs you. Yeah, that's really creepy.
And I love the fact that you know the entirety of World 8 is basically Bowser's army. That he like his military force that he's mustering to take over the Mushroom Kingdom.
It's like one level is like a tank, like a tank battalion. You're like jumping across tanks, and sort of like an airship thing.
And then his ship, which you can just swim under the entire time if you want to just wuss out and be like, all right, I'm just swimming under.
I wussed out.
I did that every time as a kid, but it was kind of, you know, like you arrive in Mordor. You never went to Bowser's domain before in a Mario game.
So true. One does not simply walk into World 8.
No, you have to, start at World 1. Yeah, or Warp Whistle.
And that Bowser fight was a new thing. Like they didn't it was the beginning of your last Bowser fight will be different from all the other bosses you face kind of thing. It'll have a trick to it.
And I mean, I never figured out the trick.
No, me neither.
I was going to say, Ray, I mean, it feels slightly unintuitive because in no other case are you invincible when you duck. But in this one boss fight, if you duck when Bowser jumps on you, you are invincible. And that's how you get him to break through the rocks. It's true.
I
just used timing and scrambled out of the way.
That's one
that
way to do
much
it.
Much better.
And like, wow. When I never got to World 8 as a kid, and I would talk to other students and ask them about, like, what's the Bowser fight like? And basically what they told me is you have to get Bowser to kill himself. And I'm like, what is happening at the end of Mario 3?
Wow, it's like Mass Effect.
God. Or like Fallout.
Use the dialogue tree.
Yeah. But yeah.
Take the knife.
So you're talking Bowser into suicide. No, actually, you basically have to cause him to break through the ground into the lava below and send him to a painful death.
That's a kind of like hoisted by his own petard ending that I feel like Miyamoto prefers in those type of games, that he doesn't want Mario to like, and then it ends with Mario killing his enemy.
It's very Disney.
Disney
heroes never kill the bad guy. The bad guy destroys himself. Like Gaston hangs himself in Beauty and the Beast because he's
arrogant. He falls off.
I'm thinking of Tarzan.
Tarzan. It's the very grisly hanging on screen.
Yeah, and like
you see the shadow. You see the
that's gonna give some kids some great dreams.
Donkey Kong was like that too, in a way.
So we're going to run out of time quickly, but I did want to go over some of the related media because, as I said in the beginning of this episode, Nintendo really they did not quite have the marketing savvy that Sega did with Sonic 2 and Sonic 1, but they really were taking off in terms of just like how do we get our message out outside of Nintendo Power? That's great. That's a great tool for marketing, but we need more than that. So we have, of course, The Wizard, the 1989 movie, came out in Christmas of that year, and I did a Retronauts episode about it in 2012. If you check the archive of Retronauts that we don't own at archive.org, you can find that episode. And as I said in that episode, I was astounded by the amount of times that Nintendo and video games weren't a major element. It's just like they're kind of in the background of this mediocre family comedy, right?
Yeah, no, I was on that episode too.
Yeah, Ray was on the episode.
That's – they only say the word Nintendo once. So.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, the main appeal of that for kids is you saw Mario 3 at this video game Armageddon. Is that what it's called?
Video
Armageddon, yeah. The riff tracks for this is great though if you don't want to watch it on your own.
And if you're a fan of The Who, it's just Tommy but without music or
that's true.
Or good acting.
Instead of pinball, it's Double Dragon.
Or drugs.
Yeah. Exactly. But the funny thing about this movie is, of course, like this game wasn't out. It was unveiled in the movie as a new challenge, but for some reason the girl character knows the secrets
of how to do it.
Just like, what the hell? They were cheating.
Usenet,
oh God. The dark web.
They're on Quantum Link.
So, of course, we also have, which I believe is the first for Nintendo, a McDonald's tie-in.
Yeah.
That really got me, man. Yeah.
Before any sort of social media or messaging you could do to children, this was the way to get your game in front of kids, associated with delicious junk food that programs their brain to like things. And we learned in the Sonic episode that Sonic 3 had to come out at a certain time because they made a deal with McDonald's. Like they had to release their game. And the toys you got for this – most of them were crappy. I brought the one toy that I had as a kid. It's the jumping Koopa Troopa. It's like you squeeze a little valve and he kind of jumps.
It's a paratrooper. It's
one of those paratrooper toys. You're right, yeah.
One of the toys.
I thought those were soft serve ice cream cones.
it is the most well modeled of all four toys.
Well, right. Yeah. I think the one of Luigi on a cloud isn't bad.
What does it do, though?
It's more like Luigi burying his crotch in a cloud.
Yeah. He has a wide stance, that's for sure. I mean, The Mario, the hopping Mario one, I just ripped the coil off of it because I was like, well, I like him okay as the toy, but him, it's too hard to play with this dumb spring on.
That's one of the few Happy Meal toys outside of like Lego or something that is like the same thing that was already existed prior. There was another like suction cup Poppy Mario, just not
I didn't know that.
The raccoon tail.
Let's listen to the commercial.
Oh boy.
It's going to be good.
Mario! Look, Ronald, Mario's mystery block makes him big.
And my magic box makes us lunch.
Awesome. Great job.
What's in McDonald's Happy Meal? One of four Nintendo Super Mario Brothers 3 toys. A Mario toy that jumps. Or an acrobatic little Goomba. A pullback Luigi. Or a hopping Koopa Paratroopa. One toy with each Happy Meal you buy.
So those are all the toys.
They basically all do some variation of a shitty hop.
Yeah, it's true. I guess that was the one idea that went with like, oh yeah, jumping. Mario's about jumping. Everything jumps in the game.
Here's a funny thing. I live in San Jose now, but like 27 years ago, I went there to visit my sister when she lived there. And like on one of the last days, this was like in the summer, right, or spring, whenever that Happy Meal came out. It's like I had to find out about that Happy Meal by seeing it in someone else's car in the parking lot.
Oh, my God.
Immediately freaked the fuck out and need to have all of that stuff.
Well,
and then we had to go back home.
I was going
to
say that was Little Ray Barnhold's first B&E.
Should have been.
Yeah. I was a Happy Meal kid. I loved all the Happy Meals, but also it was that – so we definitely collected them, but it was also that my mom – I realize now my mom had a collector's obsession with them. Like she would – I think I as a kid thought of like how nice of my mom to try to get me every Happy Meal toy by buying Happy Meals. But I think it was just an obsession of her own too.
Dark secret.
And she now calls it my inheritance. It's just this like giant bag of all these doubles of Happy Meal toys.
I have a garbage bag of Baby Kermit on a skateboard, Henry.
Yeah.
That's her inheritance.
And all the Fraggles and all the Bambi characters and all the transforming ones.
So to go through a few of the other things before we wrap up, we have the awkwardly named tie-in cartoon. It's literally called The Adventures of Super Mario Brothers 3, like the adventures of product you should buy.
Yes.
And I loved that one.
Listen,
it is the best of the Deke trilogy.
It like, really is.
Super Show is just trash where they just go like, we're in Star Wars world. We're in Samurai world. And then meanwhile in the
– it's Billy the Koopa.
And then in Super Mario World, it's just too caveman-y and ugly.
Yeah.
This one was the one where they stuck the closest to the character designs and the worlds and the enemies. It still has very stupid things
it's
in
bad,
it.
It's bad, yeah. Yes. It's still bad, right?
I forget the actor's name who did Mario voice, but he's the one true Mario voice, and I won't hear otherwise.
Oh, I like Captain Lou, even though that was one of the worst cartoons. I like Captain Lou's voice.
And, also it was when they finally were coloring Mario's hair as brown under his hat instead of black,
gasp.
Which they did in Super That's right. Show. And that was just a change in the three. Actually, no, in two, in the official art, in two.
All right, I get it. He changes it.
But I think the most okay. So Morton Koopa Jr. puts us in time in 1990. What even puts us more in time is the, of course, infamous episode in which Milli Vanilli play a major role. And if you want to see the Mario Brothers rescue Milli Vanilli from King Koopa, it's on YouTube. It happens. You can go find it yourself because I refuse to play it on this show.
Well,
but.
you do have to watch it on YouTube because the one on the DVD, they didn't pay the song rights for the Milli Vanilli songs. So.
And I doubt that's actually Milli and Vanilli doing their own voices. I think it's just cartoon voice actors doing German accents.
You also get to see the princess in like that 90s sweater.
Yes. Okay, Princess Peach wearing a baggy Milli Vanilli sweater for an entire episode. I mean, this happened. It's real. And I'm fascinated with it.
She is Robin Fabb's biggest fans. But yeah. I do believe just because of the production time, the episode aired after they were publicly shamed.
I'm pretty sure. But it's like I think we've come to understand like, oh, that's all pop music. We were just ignorant.
Yes.
No one is actually singing with their real
voice. Well, those were just a couple of poor, unfortunate male models who their album got too popular. It succeeded too well. Then they just had to be those guys.
Hey, Ashley Simpson survived the same thing.
It could have been worse. It could have been a Mario crossover with Geordi.
Geordi? Oh, the rapping French
yes,
baby?
It's tough to be a baby.
God.
Listen, that would have fit the child theme of Mario 3 too.
I wish I didn't
we
know
got
this.
Lucky.
Oh, and in the cartoon, the kid names are all different because they hadn't been localized when production began on the cartoon.
Yeah, the kids are not named in Japan. They have no names. I mean, I guess they do now. They have the American localized names, but America just named them and that was it. And then
But Deke had to name them first when making Adventures of Mario.
Inky, and Blinky, Clyde.
It's like hip hop and PewDiePie and dumb, really dumb things. And the last thing I'll talk about before you wrap up are the ports. There's a few. Of course, this is included in the Lost Levels. I like this version. Luigi gets his own sprite for the first time after Mario 2. The Luigi sprite in Mario World and in Mario 3 is just Mario of a different color. Mm-hmm. But I like this version of the game. I don't know if you guys – I know people have a problem with the Mario 1 version in Lost Levels, but I like
All Stars.
How – Oh, sorry. The Mario 1 version in All-Stars. But I like how lush Mario 3 looks in the Lost – in All-Stars.
The Lost All-Stars.
The Lost All-Stars.
No, it's very pretty in All-Stars. I like the – they put a ton of work into it that you can see on screen and all the – They basically just made the games again.
It's all more shading, basically.
Mm. Yeah, they just like airbrushed everybody a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and also that Mario was not a – he wasn't – because of the colors available on the Super NES, he wasn't just a three-toned character of just red, black, and flesh tone.
He had blue overalls and everything. So
wait, I have to challenge you for a second. I don't think Luigi got his own sprite in that until the GBA version.
No.
He has it in Lost Levels. I on purpose played – I'm sorry. He had it in All-Stars. I don't know why I keep doing that. But I played as Luigi. On purpose in that game because I'm like, this is a new Luigi sprite. Oh my god.
All right, my mistake.
It's okay. And the other version of this I'm aware of is Super Mario Advance 4, which had e-reader support. Mm-hmm. And you could buy these wacky ass levels that included gimmicks from other games like giant turnips from Mario 2 and stuff like that. I've never played these levels. I'm sure somebody like ROM hacked them into a ROM.
You can buy the Virtual Console version for Wii U.
Okay.
And it has
they put in e-reader
levels all included. Yeah.
Okay.
Damn, I'm doing that. I'll pay
like
for that.
If you don't own that, you need to get it.
As much as I don't like how they have to crop the screen for GBA, want those levels.
Some of those cards were really hard to get. I think some of them were like Walmart exclusive. Is that right?
Yeah, and some of them I think Europe didn't even get all of them.
Yeah. Having them all together, like when that came out, it was I can't believe Nintendo is doing something genuinely like good like this.
I can't wait for them to put that on the Switch in like 2022.
Yes. if that ever happens. So
we're ready to move on from Switch.
That is go ahead.
No. I loved playing it again on Advance 4. It was just the numbering was weird, but the Advance games gave you another chance to re-explore Mario games, except now they were perfect because Charles Martinet was shouting at you the entire
time. Of course,
time you played.
That's what we all wanted.
The perfect experience.
Yeah, you can't turn it off because go to hell. You're going to hear these voices.
Wahoo!
So yeah, that was our Mario 3 episode. I'm glad I got to do this. I like to revisit these games that we all treasure just to rediscover all the great things in them. When I'm playing this again over the last week, I was like, oh, I forgot about this. I forgot about that. Oh my god, this is great. Like revisiting these games is a good way to remember why we love them. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I love doing these types of episodes. I'll do more in the future. So let me know if you like it, and I will keep on keeping on. So let's wrap up. Jeremy, where can we find you?
On Twitter as GameSpite and at Retronauts.com.
I've heard of that website. And Henry, how about you?
I am HENEREYG on Twitter. You can follow me there. I also do a podcast every week with Bob Mackey. It is Talking Simpsons, where we go chronologically through every episode of The Simpsons. You can support that at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And I also did – I forgot to use this quote, but I wanted to bring it up real quick here, that some people – there's an apocryphal story that Miyamoto said that he was disappointed in this game.
Yeah.
It's not exactly – this was in a Time Magazine interview. I look back and play some of these games, and there are a lot of places where, to be honest, I'm a little embarrassed. I look at Super Mario 3 and feel like, what? This was it? This was what we thought was good enough? That being said, this is the part people don't go to. That being said, I do have new understandings of that work. The balance in that game is what it needed to be at that time. It really was. And so, even seeing all the limitations, I'm very happy with what we created, and I wouldn't change it.
I'm going to say fake news, lies, slander. Ray, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter, RDBAAA. That's all I got.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. As Henry said, we're on Talking Simpsons together every week. And also, please give to our Patreon. As I said, after the break, for $3 a month, you can get these episodes a week ahead of time, ad-free, at a higher bitrate, and you get a private feed that plugs into any podcast player or app. So that's one incentive. Go to patreon.com/retronauts. There are tiers above that if you want to give more. There are things like zines and t-shirts, or if you just want to give $1 a month to say, hey guys, here's a little tip, thanks for doing the show. Any small amount works, and if all of you guys out there gave us $1 a month, we could do all kinds of crazy awesome stuff. So please consider giving to us at patreon.com/retronauts. That's it for us this week. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. See you then.
Technology Truths, brought to you by GEICO.
Technology Truths.
Truth, you will certainly send any text about your supervisor to your supervisor.
What's with Janet's bangs? Did she lose a bet with a weed whacker? LOL. And sent. Wait, no.
Truth, it's so easy to switch and save on car insurance at GEICO.com.
Janet, I think my phone was hacked or something.
GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.